Hello and welcome to the Alcohol Alert, brought to you by the Institute of Alcohol Studies. On this month's podcast, we spoke to Dr. Catherine Saveri, IAS's Chief Executive, about the rise in alcohol deaths, and to Dr. Nason Marney, a lecturer in Inequalities and Global Health Policy at the University of Edinburgh. Dr. Marney recently published a study on the perils of partnership, which was featured in Private Eye, and looked at correspondence between Public Health England, DrinkAware, and the alcohol industry body, the Portman Group, in the run-up to their Drink Free Days campaign. We discussed what the campaign was, the collegial correspondence between Public Health England and the Portman Group, how the Portman Group asked Public Health England to not involve civil society in its alcohol advisory group, and DrinkAware's omitting of information on its website. First, Dr. Saveri and I spoke about the rise in alcohol deaths. Do read our newsletter for more information on the stats and trends regarding death statistics. The Office for National Statistics released their latest data on alcohol-specific deaths on the 22nd of April. When this recording goes out, that will be about a week ago. The data are on deaths in 2022 from reasons that are wholly attributable to alcohol. So about 75% of those alcohol-related liver disease, about 15% are mental and behavioural disorders, and about 5% are alcohol poisoning. So could you explain to us how many alcohol-specific deaths we saw in 2022, and what the sort of general trend has been over the last few years?
So the ONS reported that just over 10,000 deaths were recorded in 2022, wholly attributable to alcohol. Now, this represented a 4% increase on the previous year, but alarmingly, it represented a 33% increase since 2019. Now, this is obviously a very concerning escalation in the number of deaths linked to alcohol. But what we also need to remember in the background of this is that this figure, as you say, only represents the deaths that are 100% linked to alcohol. And there will be many further deaths that where alcohol contributes, such as alcohol-related cancers, heart disease, strokes, injuries and accidents. So the true number of deaths where alcohol played a role in most recent years is likely to be two or three times higher than this figure.
And in terms of the regions that have seen the highest number of deaths, which regions have seen the highest rates, and what's the sort of change been as well in those areas?
So the northwest of England experienced the greatest number of alcohol-specific deaths. The greatest increase in the death rate was seen in the northeast of England. Now, this is a picture that is perhaps unsurprising, as we know that there are wide inequalities, health and social inequalities, across the nation, with the northwest and the northeast often experiencing greater levels of disadvantage within communities, greater levels of health harms. So this is a pattern that we have seen emerging in recent years, but things are more acutely aware given the shock that we've seen in terms of the alarming rise in figures that's just recently been recorded.
In terms of, again, splitting out these stats a little bit, men are twice as likely to die from alcohol as women. But again, that gap has been closing in recent years. Since 2001, the rise in deaths among men has been 69% and in women 91%. Why do you think the rise in deaths has been particularly high among women?
If we know that the three main drivers of alcohol harm are affordability, availability, and promotion, it's perhaps unsurprising that we've seen an increase in consumption harm amongst women, given that in recent years, alcohol has become ever more affordable due to government cuts and freezes on duty, and inaction on evidence-based measures such as minimum unit pricing, which is in place in both Scotland and Wales. If we turn to promotion, we see somewhat you could describe as aggressive marketing campaigns from drinks companies targeting women as female consumers, often linking messages to female empowerment with particular products, female solidarity, promotions either with, you know, makeup and cosmetics brands. And this has been very well documented, how women are targeted as consumers of alcohol. I think that in general, we've seen an increase in drinking at home, and obviously the pandemic disrupted regular drinking patterns, when everybody was forced to socialise within the home. And these data would indicate that those patterns are persisting and people are choosing to stay at home rather than go out. And alcohol is much more affordable at home, and evidence indicates that people are more likely to drink more if they're drinking in the home setting than they are when they're going out. So I think that we know that although regular drivers of alcohol harm are in full force at the moment, so it's unsurprising that women are being subjected to higher rates of harm. And then the final point I would say is that women are less likely to seek and access support and treatment for alcohol problems due to a range of issues linked to stigma, concerns about childcare, concerns about childcare responsibilities, but also because not many tailored women-specific services are available. Some of the treatment services are still very male-dominated. So I think we do need to see better support services available to women, given this recent trend, to respond to what is becoming an emerging public health issue.
And looking forward to, let's say, a different administration's in by the end of the year, what would you want a new government to be looking at, how they should respond to these deaths and what you'd expect them to do to respond to this public health crisis?
We would want an incoming government to look very closely at the World Health Organization's recommendations for tackling alcohol harm. The UK is a signatory to the Global Alcohol Action Plan and the WHO European Alcohol Action Plan. And all these roadmaps present very clearly the policies that are required to reduce harm. And they include increasing the price, restricting marketing and promotions, and also enabling local communities to better decide when and where alcohol is sold.
And now over to Dr. Marnie. We asked him what the Drink Free Days campaign was and why there was controversy about it at the time.
So the Drink Free Days campaign was a campaign run as a sort of partnership between Public Health England and DrinkAware, which is a sort of alcohol health information charity that's funded primarily through industry contributions from the alcohol industry. And, you know, it was ostensibly a health promotion campaign around sort of taking days off drinking, and it was aimed at sort of middle-aged drinkers primarily. It was controversial for a few reasons. One, it was an overt partnership between Public Health England and this alcohol industry funded organization. So that was controversial in the mind of quite a lot of folks who do research in this area, on who do advocacy in relation to alcohol, and sort of have a sense of how the alcohol industry directly and indirectly tends to obstruct policy action. It was controversial because it was unclear how exactly the campaign had been designed and who had been involved. And it was also controversial because there was a kind of an air of controversy around it. So a senior advisor to Public Health England, Professor Ian Gilmore, resigned from that post as a direct consequence of the campaign. So there was sort of as it was announced, it was controversial for these reasons, for these kind of structural reasons, because of who was funding it and because of who was involved, for these kind of procedural reasons, how exactly did it come about, and then just because there was this sort of, you know, pushback and this resignation as well, and this was kind of covered in the BMJ and other articles.
Yeah, we can get to the sort of opaque design of it, and I think that's clearly what your publication, again, we'll get to, really clearly lays out. But in terms of the sort of three organisations involved, so you've got DrinkAware, Portman Group and Public Health England, for those who are sort of less familiar with these organisations, their aims, their foundation, could you explain who those three groups are?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, Public Health England, which no longer exists, but at the time was this arm's length public health agency that sort of sat separately from the Department of Health. It was sort of responsible for national level initiatives with regards to public health, disease surveillance. They did a lot of work around health promotion, supporting, you know, public health teams and directors of public health. And they were sort of like an acknowledged center of expertise and best practice around public health at the time. You know, obviously they no longer exist, and so they would produce evidence reviews, for example, on cost effectiveness of particular policies, on effectiveness of particular policies, and was sort of like these quite authoritative pieces. The Portman Group is this sort of industry responsibility body in the UK, so it has a kind of range of functions. It communicates directly to the public in a variety of ways. It is responsible for the self-regulation of alcohol marketing, particularly as it pertains to product design and labeling, and those kind of things. It also, and it has, it's kind of been running for a large number of years. In some ways, it's kind of a lobbying body because it will make submissions to government about particular policies and against particular policies. In some ways, it's a kind of a public relations organization. It'll communicate to the public on the benefits of alcohol industry initiatives, on this kind of thing. And it's sort of a semi-self-regulatory body in that it facilitates like advertising complaints and the management of advertising complaints and sort of voluntary codes for alcohol marketing in the UK. So it's, in other words, it's a hard one to pin down because it seems to vary depending on who the audience is and what the issue is. And then DrinkAware is a charity that was originally set up by the Portman Group to communicate on alcohol harm. Originally, it was set up, I believe, with a memorandum of understanding with government to do this, but always funded by the industry. And then later, it was sort of spun off as an independent trust, separate to the Portman Group in terms of its, legal structure, but remained funded by the alcohol industry and has been since for many years. So DrinkAware, for those of you who, you know, have seen alcohol advertisements, you'll see like for the facts, go to DrinkAware or the DrinkAware logo in like the bottom corner. So in a lot of alcohol ads or on, you know, TV adverts, it's sort of like signposted in the ad as if you want to find out more facts about alcohol, then that's where you kind of go. And DrinkAware also do a kind of commission polls. They do kind of health promotion campaigns, and they have a website that is where people are directed to basically for alcohol health information.
Could you explain what your study looked at and why you think this focus was important?
Well, so our study sought to kind of complement work that had already been done, both about these types of organizations, so the Portman Group and DrinkAware. So there are parallels to these organizations in lots of different countries. Like there's DrinkWise in Australia, there's DrinkAware Ireland. In Ireland, you know, there's like Edu Alcohol in Canada. They have differences in terms of who the precise nature of funding arrangements and the history of these organizations, but they're all these kind of national level alcohol information charities. They're sort of viewed as the go-to point for alcohol information by many members of the public, but are also funded directly or indirectly by the alcohol industry. And there's quite a lot of scholarship around these organizations already. So looking at textual analyses of the nature of the information they put out, sort of nudges or dark nudges in the kind of health promotion materials they do, what their Twitter content is like over time and how it responds to kind of key events in alcohol policy or key times of the year. And basically a lot of this research has found that these organizations, their content differs materially from that of independent charities. So there's value in looking at these organizations from that perspective, because they tend to be much more vague around specific population level alcohol harms, particularly cancer. They tend to focus a lot more on sort of vague terms like responsible drinking or, you know, getting home safe, and less on this sort of clear scientific consensus around, for example, the links between alcohol and breast cancer. They almost never, very rarely, mention WHO or policy best buys around availability, affordability, or marketing regulations. which again is very different from what you'd find on an independent alcohol charity website, where you know those would be front and center. So there's value in looking at them because the industry funds them, and they clearly serve some kind of strategic purpose, and they differ materially from what independent charities put out. And there was value, I think, in getting under the surface of what a partnership like this actually means and how it operates. And so there had been these public evaluations of the Drink Free Days campaign, but they'd be based on interviews with stakeholders or based on publicly available materials, but not about the kind of communications behind the scenes. And because it was all so opaque to begin with, we felt that was a valuable lens. So we submitted freedom of information requests for communications between the leadership figures of each of these organizations to try and get a sense of like to what degree there was coordination and top level, you know, interactions in the run up to the partnership and then during the partnership and in response to the criticism.
So getting into the more juicy aspect of your findings, and I'd really encourage anybody listening to read through the publication, which is open access, and there's some very interesting and quite shocking, I think, bits in it, particularly around the interactions between Public Health England and the Portman Group in the run-up to the campaign. How would you describe these interactions?
Well, I mean, so it's worth saying at the outset that when you're doing these kind of freedom of information requests, you're only going to get, you have to be quite narrow in your focus, otherwise they'll get refused because they require too much work. So in this case, it was mainly the email exchanges are between the leadership figures of each of these organizations. So we don't know if there were other, you know, there are probably other communications ongoing at a variety of levels that these may have not have captured. But what we see from the interactions between, for example, Public Health England, as you mentioned, that sort of the head of Public Health England and the Portman Group in the run-up to the campaign, is that they are in contact from time to time, direct contact, and there is a kind of collegial element to it. They're discussing meeting. The head of PHE presents at the Portman Group's kind of board meeting. They're talking about working together on communicating on alcohol and risk. And there's this kind of like very much functional relationship in which they're exchanging information. And the surprising thing is that this is at somewhat at odds with later public communication in defense of the Drink Free Days campaign. So when the criticism came out about the Drink Free Days campaign, once it became public, the sort of defense was, well, we're working with DrinkAware, which is an independent charity, which, you know, receives funds from the industry but is independent from the industry. We're not working with the industry. And the email exchanges show that, well, in parallel, there was this kind of direct working relationship with the industry, and they were, you know, discussing initiatives and talking. So that was quite shocking. I think the thing that was also quite shocking was that the Portman Group, which again is our marketing regulator, by the way, just want to flag that, was also kind of pushing back on aspects of Public Health England's work around alcohol. So they were disputing the focus of Public Health England's rapid review on the effectiveness of alcohol policies and the cost effectiveness of alcohol policies, arguing that, you know, it wasn't taking into account complexities like the kind of alcohol harm paradox and the fact that this is all complicated due to inequality and these kind of things. They were also complaining about the makeup of Public Health England's advisory board on alcohol and saying that there were organizations and charities involved who had a conflict of interest, either because the Portman Group said they were anti-alcohol or funded by temperance groups, or because the Portman Group said that even that if an organization or a person had a public opinion on an alcohol policy, then they were conflicted and they couldn't be part of the advisory group, which, I mean, anyone who has any expertise in alcohol at some point has said, I think this policy would be a good idea, or I think this policy would be a bad idea. So it sort of excludes almost all civil society by that kind of, by that, you know, with that kind of lens. So there are these quite powerful interventions on behalf of the Portman Group seeking to influence the work Public Health England was doing and who else Public Health England was associating with.
It's a quite unbelievable irony, really, if you read the paper and consider who Portman Group is and that they are the industry. I mean, I'll just quote the bit that you're referencing there in terms of the Public Health England evidence review, which came out in 2016 and was an incredibly comprehensive review of the evidence around alcohol and how to reduce harm, and ended up essentially recommending or highlighting the overwhelming evidence around price, availability, and marketing. So the World Health Organization Best Buys that you mentioned earlier. And just on that, what you're talking about, the sort of trying to exclude all of civil society, the Portman Group asked PHE for, and I quote, reassurance that members of the group do not have track records in publicly campaigning for or against any of the alcohol policy evaluations your evidence review will be evaluating, as this would make it impossible for them to be objective or independent in their advice. So yeah, as you say, this would exclude any public health charity that focuses on alcohol at all, because of all of these measures, I think, have a huge wealth of evidence over decades. And so it would only end up being sort of the industry that would be involved at that point.
The industry and industry-funded charities who do not mention alcohol best buys on their websites, which is like you say, it is quite a remarkably narrow and distorted way of viewing conflict of interest, isn't it?
I mean, before speaking, so last week I had a look on Drinkaware's website, because I think this is, I was going to come to this later, but we can discuss this now, that Public Health England raised concerns about the content of Drinkaware's website during the design and implementation of the Drink Free Days campaign. And if you look at their website now, you might think, yeah, there's lots of great information and lots of it's evidence-based. And it's very well set out because they've got lots of money to make it look nice. But as you and other researchers have clearly identified, it's what they're omitting that's the most important. And if you try and find any evidence on their website of the evidence base of price, availability, and marketing, it's very, very difficult to find. And actually, this was something that Public Health England essentially asked Drinkaware to include 7 or so years ago. Could you explain the concerns that Public Health England raised about Drinkaware's website a bit further, and why Public Health England clearly felt the need to try and improve it?
Yeah, so again, with the caveat that we only know kind of what the emails reveal, and that's always, I guess, part of the, you know, it's part but not all of the story. There were two main concerns that seemed to come through in the emails, and they had to be pretty significant because they're, again, communicating these concerns between the leadership figures in these organizations. So one is around the causal relationship between alcohol and cancer. So the head of PHE asks if their medical advisors, the medical advisors of at PHE, could speak with the medical advisors at Drinkaware about the causal links between alcohol and cancer, and if they could contribute some references to help support this. And he says, you know, we believe the evidence says cause, and that the weight supports this. So they're kind of they're saying that you're not making that kind of causal language clear enough. And he says, it's not a small matter that we get this right to those who do not wish our nascent partnership to thrive. So it's explicitly seen as, because it's something that the public health community is sensitive to, and because there's this evidence that there is this kind of distortion by the industry around the links between alcohol and cancer, that they see this as a potential sort of critical weakness that they need to address. The other thing, as you mentioned, that comes up separately is this idea that, so, and it's kind of remarkable that they get quite late on in the partnership before Public Health England realize that there's no information about policy best buys, including the evidence review that Public Health England has just done. So while, you know, Public Health England is signposting people to the Drink Free Days campaign and adding their logo next to Drinkaware's and sending people to this microsite, which is funded by Drinkaware, and, you know, Drinkaware is also doing has their own website around Drink Free Days, Drinkaware is not providing any information on policy best buys or on the work Public Health England, their so-called partner in this, has done in the form of the evidence review. And it's quite fascinating because what happened at the time, it's hard to evidence this now because it came and left in terms of the Drinkaware website, was that they added a link to the Public Health England evidence review. It wasn't that there were big sections of the website added that explained, here's the evidence around price, affordability, or what the evidence review had to say about industry-funded education campaigns, because it said that they were ineffective. But they just sort of added a link to the evidence review as a way of, again, I think, I imagine, can't say but speculating, addressing that concern from Public Health England and moving on.
Or as one of the staff members, unnamed, said, and I quote, "It will go some way to closing down the criticisms of these ivory tower professors," which I think Ian Gilmore might be quite pleased about being told. I guess, yeah. this does raise the question of why Public Health England engaged in this partnership to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one because it's hard to know the answer. But I do think, in general, one of the reasons that partnerships with these types of organisations appeal is, as you say, they're in some ways they're very well funded, right, to do health promotion campaigns. They receive a lot of visitors, and they're signposted to on all alcohol advertising. The industry is very happy for government to work with these organisations, and so there are a lot of, from a kind of the lens of kind of a political leader, it's a kind of a win-win in many ways, because it doesn't require budget input from Public Health England. This is like something Drinkware is funding, is putting in all the money. Drinkware provides the website, you know, all these kind of things. So you can understand how, in some ways, it's kind of like, well, this is far better than nothing, and we should do this. Or, you know, these kind of often trotted out arguments of, you know, this is the world as it is, and we need to meet people where they are. And, you know, like this is a framing this kind of partnership as innovation or brave or bold. So I think it's possible, and certainly the public communications at the time by leadership were around those lines, that we need to meet people where they are, that, you know, we're... And internally in the emails, they say this is about reframing our relationship with the alcohol industry as well. So it's like that's part of what they propose to do. But of course, the challenge with this is that in any such decision, there are potential trade-offs. And these organizations exist for strategic reasons. They're funded for strategic reasons for these kind of alcohol industry companies. And they serve those strategic purposes directly and indirectly, even just through their existence alone. So if you're partnering with this kind of organization, that means you're not partnering with an independent alcohol charity. And if you're sending people to this kind of website, that means you're not sending them to a website that, you know, might have information on these other, right, other key areas. And you're, you know, in essence, you're substituting what might be effective action for action that the alcohol industry is comfortable with, in part because it's not effective. It won't impact their bottom line as much.
That's really important to highlight again, really, that with Drinkaware, for instance, lots of people know Drinkaware. Lots of people don't know that Drinkaware is industry funded. And those that do know that it's funded will often say, well, yeah, they've got all this good information though. So, but ignoring what we've highlighted about what they emit, or not ignoring it, but sort of complementing that, is why would Diageo and other major alcohol producers fund Drinkaware if Drinkaware was effectively working to reduce alcohol consumption and harm? I mean, harm, they might say that they are up for reducing harm, but to do that, you need to reduce alcohol consumption. And very clearly, that will reduce the bottom line of the alcohol industry. So why would shareholders be up for that? I think that's really important to highlight. And that's, again, back to the omitting of evidence and not including Public Health England's very comprehensive review. In terms of your publication, and it would be useful also to sort of reflect on what happened with the Drink Free Days campaign. What would you like your publication to say to people, particularly because these correspondents were from quite a while ago, and I think Drinkaware would say that they are in a different place now. But could you sort of, yeah, reflect on where you would like, what you want people to take from your publication?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I think, first of all, I think it's acknowledging that there are these hidden indirect effects, you know, of these kind of partnerships and these kind of organizations. So one example would be the othering, the marginalization of large swathes of civil society. I mean, you know, the emails show how you had dozens and dozens of civil society groups asking to meet with the head of Public Health England, register complaints, you know, from a range of like learned associations, professional associations. And the fact that committing to a partnership of this kind kind of puts you at odds with such a wide swathe of civil society, but at that point your reputation is so tied to the partnership that has been your initiative, right? Because it hasn't it because it's been something that you very much led on. You're sort of trapped, and I sort of like I think understanding that those kind of dynamics of association, and then needing to manage criticism, and then finding yourself separated from large swathes of civil society that are very important for you in terms of doing the job as best you can, I think is really important. And that's kind of one example of the kind of wider kind of trade-offs of proceeding with this kind of course action. I think it's, if anything, it's more relevant now because in the wake of COVID-19 and restructuring and, you know, the moving away from Public Health England, in some ways there's even less resources for Public Health England, for this OHID and similar organizations to do work on these kind of topics now. Politically, it feels like there isn't necessarily much support or wiggle room at times. And so in some ways, the pressures to partner and the pressures to either find ways to work with industry are greater than or perhaps greater than they have been at any point in time. And yet the potential trade-offs are also potentially greater than they have been at any point in time, because we're at a point of time of like and the recent data shows this spiking alcohol specific and likely alcohol related death rates. And again, when you think about the role of the Portman Group and these kind of organizations, and even just framing why these things are happening and how to address them, having them involved directly in partnership means that they have many more opportunities to do that, to sort of say, oh, well, it's all very complex, it's not due to us, and we're doing these corporate social responsibility initiatives to combat it, rather than going back to the evidence and thinking, well, like what do we know in terms of effectiveness, and what do we know in terms of cost effectiveness, and sort of proceeding on that basis. So in a way, I hope that people read the paper both to get a sense of how these things operate on the inside and the extent to which they involve these kind of interpersonal relationships and you know, challenges behind the scenes that don't make it into the light of day, but also that it informs what organizations like OHID are thinking right now about what, you know, what we need in terms of a UK alcohol strategy and who we should or should not involve in those conversations.
I think before we end, it's also important to highlight the fact that this isn't just a matter of a number of years ago. The Health Select Committee very recently held an evidence session, and they're writing a strategy basically about prevention, alcohol harm prevention. And the first people that they spoke to, the first witnesses they heard from, three of those were, well, two of those were very much industry, so the Portman Group and the British Beer and Pub Association, and then one of them was Drinkaware. And tied into that were comments similar to the sort of correspondence that you unearthed, which was sort of trying to make civil society look like they were an evidence base. So there's this comment from the chief exec of the Portman Group about how the Alcohol Health Alliance, which had run a survey back in 2022 or 2020, I can't quite remember, about alcohol labelling. The chief exec of Portman Group said that the survey was wrong. Just said, that is wrong. We don't recognise those figures and they are wrong. And there's not much you can respond to that, really. But this, yeah, clearly shows that this is a current issue. And although they are holding a second evidence session with people from alcohol harm charities, the fact that they ran this one first is quite shocking to people in the public health community.
It is, and to be honest, I think you're absolutely right to mention that. And we wrote about this a little bit in the BMJ, that the fact that it's shocking in a way is a good thing, or the fact that we're so slowly moving to a place where the idea that, you know, that's where we would go to first for evidence on prevention would be these kind of organizations. The fact that that's shocking, I think, is important, and it needs to be. I think that's part of that unity building around, like, this just simply isn't effective, isn't in line with WHO recommendations, isn't in line with civil society is demanding or what the experts are recommending. But you're right, it is also a sign that we have a lot further to go in terms of separating the industry and industry narratives from this. One of the other phrases I found really striking from that evidence session when I was listening to it was that because they were there first, it wasn't explicitly framed as this is an industry session or this is where we're hearing. It wasn't framed in that way. It was just said this is the first session on alcohol prevention. Was that I can't remember which of the two industry bodies it was, but they said that, you know, here in the UK, you know, we're regarded as a gold standard when it comes to self-regulation. And I thought that was really striking, that when you do these kind of things, these kind of claims can be made and sort of be unchallenged. So it is very important that more evidence and more consensus is built around the role of these kind of organizations and these kind of narratives.
That is all for this month. Thank you for listening, and we hope you can join us in next month's podcast.